In the lead up to World War II, Britain desperately needed more fighter planes, but there was a crucial gap in the supply chain. How were these new planes to reach the bases of the Royal Air Force? If they were damaged, how would they get to the workshops for repair? The obvious answer is to fly them. This is the story of the men and women who donned their flying jackets and slid into the cockpits to do just that. I'm Tuppence Middleton, and this is Spitfire, the people's plane. To understand these men and women, you have to understand a little about their life before the war. They were an elite and extraordinary group. The First World War had utterly transformed aircraft technology, and in the peacetime that followed, this led to a booming new leisure industry for those who could afford it. For a particular strand of the British upper classes, to have your own plane was absolutely the thing.
It was tremendous fun.
Joan Hughes was flying solo in her own plane at the extraordinary age of 15.
It was a brotherhood, sisterhood of pilots who had this extraordinary thing in common, which was that they could fly.
Giles Whittell has written a book about them.
It could be in Bavaria one day and then they'd be in Hungary the next, and then they'd make their way back through northern France and fly across the Channel.
Everybody went charging off, more or less anywhere. Flying was a bit of a thing.
It was really the golden age of the private flyer. It's never been such fun since.
Lady Rosemary de Crow spent her summers flying all over Europe.
No commercial aircraft saying you've gotten our way. You just went. Every aero club used to give a sort of party during the summer. It was very great fun.
It's a bug. And you know, once you've got it, you can never seem to get rid of it. Just to sort of be in the air. One really can't explain it. I would rather have flown than eaten, really.
One member of this unique flying elite was a wealthy banker called Gerard Delonger, but everyone called him Pop. In his late 30s, he was too old for the RAF, but he wanted to find a way to do his bit.
Gerard Pop Delonger went to the Air Ministry to say, come on, there are a lot of pilots in the country who you're not going to be able to use as combat pilots, but who are available to help, want to help. Let us do so. So that led to the establishment of the ATA.
The ATA was a group of civilian airmen who, due to age or injury, couldn't fly into battle, but knew their way around a cockpit. Richard Pode is chairman of the ATA Museum in Maidenhead near London.
ATA stands for Air Transport Auxiliary, but there are lots of other versions of this. The one right at the beginning, with all the old men joining in September 39, was Ancient and Tattered Airmen. The RAF periodically complained about ATA's one-eyed pilots. They had three pilots who only had one eye, but none of them ever bent an aeroplane.
At this stage, the ATA was a men's organisation. No woman had ever flown an RAF plane. But these developments were being watched keenly by a woman called Pauline Gower. Pauline Gower was a shrewd businesswoman and made her living by giving joyrides and doing aerobatics for adoring crowds.
When I first studied the intricacies of aircraft construction, I was astonished to realise how many parts there were and how greatly one part depended on another. Any weakness in one link was sufficient to break the chain and cause disaster.
She was incredibly determined, steel-trapped mind. She was nerveless, totally unafraid, and she was immensely successful in gradually, incrementally using highly positioned men to help her.
Pauline was a master of the art of gentle, firm, but unrelenting pressure. She wrote to Delonger. She lunched with the Director General of Civil Aviation. She pulled strings and called in favours. The result was a commission to head up a brand new women's section of the ATA. Young Joan Hughes was among those Pauline had her eye on.
Well, we all had to go down to Bristol and we were flight tested, and then there was an agonising wait until you were told if you were selected or not.
The result was the recruitment in 1939 of the first eight. The first eight women to wear the ATA uniform. And they were not exactly a diverse cross-section of society.
There's Lady Rosemary Ducrow, who you've heard, and Marion Wilberforce, daughter of a Scottish laird who reportedly used to transport prize bullocks in the back of her plane.
They were devil-may-care, unusual, brassy, clipped.
There was Mona Friedlander, who played ice hockey for Great Britain, Winnie Crossley, who had been a stunt pilot for a circus.
They were all somewhat eccentric. They had to be, because this was not just an expensive and unusual thing to do, it was really dangerous as well.
From the very beginning, their gender marked them out, in good ways and in bad.
Well, there was an awful lot of adverse publicity to begin with. And we knew if anything went a bit wrong, of course it would be screaming headlines, women smashing our RAF airplanes. What are these women doing being allowed to fly them?
There were some famously misogynistic responses, including from C.G. Grey, the editor of Aeroplane magazine. The menace is the woman who thinks
they ought to be flying a high-speed bomber, when she really has not the intelligence to scrub the floor of a hospital properly, or who wants to nose around as an air raid warden and yet can't cook her husband's dinner.
If you flew, you were obviously rather a sort of racy type. You probably smoked and drank and heaven knows, not quite the thing really.
The British media is renowned from treating people as villains one day and heroes the next. Within months, the press realised they'd got a glamour story on their hands and they ran with it for the rest of the war.
We were regarded as a sort of joke. And they used to call us ATA girls, ATA, you know? Here come the girls. And everyone used to roar with laughter. It was fun, actually. Much nicer than people looking down their noses.
The intense scrutiny on their every move was felt by all of them.
You daren't have an accident. You were terrified to have an accident because it would just muck it up for everybody.
Lady Rosemary Ducrow.
If a man took the thing up and broke it, it was just too bad, of course. But if we'd broken one, immediately they'd say, you see, we said they couldn't do it, and they can't. And so we had to be twice as careful as everybody else. It was a terrible weight to carry.
At first, these pioneering women were limited to flying trainer aircraft. The old-fashioned open cockpit biplanes, like the de Havilland Gypsy Moth that the RAF used to train new pilots. They flew these open cockpit planes for hours at a time and through freezing weather.
My God, it was cold. Open airplanes, no heating, no nothing. And it didn't seem to matter what you wore, balaclavas, scarves, the lot. You always seemed to get a draught going straight down your neck. It was quite funny sometimes when you'd stop to refuel. Your face was so frozen, you could hardly talk.
It took tragedy to give the first eight their first real big break.
The turning point for the women in moving from freezing open cockpit Tiger Moths to the bigger, faster, let's face it, cooler planes was the Battle of Britain because of the sheer number of pilots lost to the RAF.
Around 500 aircrew from Fighter Command lost their lives in the devastating dogfights of 1940. Britain's survival hung in the balance. They needed more. More men coming through the RAF training programmes, more planes coming out of the factories, and more delivery pilots to connect the two. Pauline wasted no time. She wrote to Pop Delange, imploring him to give her girls the chance to help.
Delange didn't reply. Gower didn't take it personally. She went, as she put it, around the blockage, classic Gower, and had lunch with Air Marshal Christopher Courtney, who in turn took it right to the top.
Pauline got the green light they'd all been waiting for. she could finally expand the women's section of the ATA, take on more pilots, and train them up to scratch. And by the middle of 1941, Pauline was instructed to bring five of her best women to be flight tested on something much more powerful. The Hawker Hurricane, the partner fighter with the Spitfire. It was a pivotal moment. Joan Hughes was one of the five.
They then said, "All right, we'll let you have a go on the Hurricane." And five of us were allowed to do a circuit in a Hurricane. Of course, one was a bit nervous that one might make a mess of it. But one was so terribly pleased to be doing it. We were then allowed to fly Hurricanes and then went on to Spitfires, and then it was away.
Until then, the men had kept the women, as it were, subjugated in the boring, slow types, and they'd kept all the fancy stuff to themselves. From that day on, women could fly all the fighters and all the twin-engine bombers as well.
By the middle of 1942, they were taking pilots from all over the world. Airwomen from the USA, from Poland, Chile, Australia and South Africa made the perilous journey to the UK to sign up to serve with the ATA. They also took on new recruits with no flying experience and trained them up. One of the pilots that signed up later in the war was a dark-haired, bright-eyed, 5'2" ball of laughter called Monique Agazarian, but known to everyone as Aggie.
It was the most wonderful training when you think of it, really.
Aggie almost didn't make the grade.
Once you'd got your wings, and I nearly didn't get them because apparently I laughed a lot. And they thought I wasn't serious. And so the commanding officer, when I went up for my wings check, not a smile out of him, a face like an old boot all the way through. And instead of taking about an hour and a half, it took 2 hours. I couldn't understand this. Anyhow, I came back and I was so dejected by this time. I thought, oh, you know. He got out and he turned around to me and he said, "You were very good." You know, and I thought, I couldn't understand this.
The Hurricane may have been the first, but it wasn't long before one plane was to become a firm favourite. Sleek and powerful, graceful but deadly. The Spitfire. It took the first eight women 2 years to get into the cockpit of a Spit. By 1943, it took Aggie a mere 60 hours.
Once you'd done your 60 hours, back you came, you flew the Harvard, and then you got the Spitfire. They said, "There's the Spitfire. Take it away for now." I mean, I just can't tell you. I was petrified that something would happen and they wouldn't let me fly it, but they did. And it was the most wonderful aeroplane in the world. You didn't have to fly it, you just thought about it. I used to waltz around those great big fluffy clouds. But you could waltz in and out. Oh, it was marvellous.
Jadwiga Piłsudska, one of the three Polish pilots who flew Spitfires, told me everyone loved them, but especially the women, she said. Helen Ritchie, who was an American pilot, called the Spitfire a fish through water, a sharp knife through butter, a bullet through the skull. And there was a pilot from South Africa, Jackie Soror. She wrote about the Spitfire in particular, and that's she's worth quoting. She said, "It seemed the most natural thing in the world to be sitting
in the cockpit, as though my entire life had led to this moment. I started up inexpertly and felt the power coursing through the Spitfire's frame. Carefully, I familiarised myself with the controls. As the ground fell away at fantastic speed, I felt exhilarated by the eager, sensitive response. Singing with joy and relief, I dived and climbed and spiralled round the broken clouds."
The ATA flew without instruments, without radio and without weapons, and the routes were often fraught with danger. Joy Lofthouse joined the ATA in 1943.
But the balloons, other than the weather, barrage balloons are one of another big problem.
Around every big city, these enormous hydrogen balloons, nearly 20 metres in length, held aloft thick steel cables rigged with explosives to ensnare any pilot fool enough to fly through them.
They had an alleyway. You went in through the balloons. But they changed that every day so that the Germans couldn't get wind of the way in.
Lettice Curtis
was one of the most technically proficient flyers in the ATA, but she wasn't immune to the danger.
One day I took off without checking because I thought I knew, and flew in the usual way and flew out again. When I got home that evening, I was told that I'd flown through the barrage. There was a lot of low cloud that day, and I hadn't seen anything. I'd gone through and missed the lot. Even now, my stomach turns over when I think of it.
It's rather strange because it's over the background of really the horror of the war. You looked every day to see who'd been killed, and it really was awful, but the job was the most wonderful job in the world.
The ATA was disbanded in November 1945. Peace had come, and their services were no longer required. But peace could not have come without them, and their work was pivotal to the Allied victory in the air. Pauline Gower knew just how important their work had been.
A great and strong chain has been forged by the people of this country. Enduring the blood and tears and sweat through which we have passed, it has never broken. Lives have been and are being given cheerfully every day, and ferry pilots are among those who have made the great sacrifice.
The story of the ATA is often told, as we've told it here, as a story about women. But really, it was a story about bravery, regardless of sex or gender. The 1,152 male pilots of the ATA vastly outnumbered the 168 women. But the women of the ATA did something else, too. They broke through in quite spectacular style the glass ceiling of the air industry. They got not only equal work and equal pay, but equal respect for the work they did, and were instrumental in changing forever the public perception of women's bravery and skill. There was one woman who changed the course of the war and the design of the Spitfire without ever leaving the ground. In the next episode of Spitfire, the People's Plane, you'll hear her story. One of the BBC World Service's most popular podcasts this year has been the second season of 13 Minutes to the Moon. It tells the story of the dramatic rescue of Apollo 13 following a catastrophic explosion in the depths of space, featuring the voices of the astronauts and engineers themselves. But we never got to hear the end of the story, because the presenter, Kevin Fong, just happens to have a day job as a doctor, now working in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and we paused production to let him focus on that. However, the climactic final episode is now nearly ready for launch, and it'll be available in the 13 Minutes to the Moon feed from the 8th of June. In the meantime, if you haven't already heard the rest of the award-winning series, now is the perfect time to catch up. Just search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts.